WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
And welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann, and my guest today, he writes about pro wrestling for Grantland.com, David Shoemaker, a.k.a. The Masked Man. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and thanks so much for being on the show. We're going to talk about a very interesting movie, documentary that looks at independent pro wrestling in the South. It is Fake It So Real, and you wrote about this, kind of about documentary films in general, for an article for Grantland. And you know, what were your just initial impressions of the movie?
I thought it was really good. I think documentaries. I mean, I don't want to like get too meta. I mean, documentaries are kind of an interesting art form in general. But especially now with this like incredible, there's so many documentaries being made every year, and it's kind of really hard to make a bad documentary. It seems that, you know, as long as you have like an interesting subject matter and like some level of competence, then you can make something that's like, you know, is like a totally acceptable way to spend 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But I thought this one was really good. I mean, I saw it in a gigantic like backyard behind a bar in Brooklyn, which is where I live, and it's part of an outdoor film series, and it was just the best place. I mean, the best environment to see probably any movie, but that movie in particular. It got dark right before the movie started, and they had a giant ring set up in front of the screen, and it was really, really great. And the best part about it, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead, but the best part about it was there were a few hundred people there. I could have counted the wrestling fans on one hand, and everybody just loved the movie. So
yeah,
that made it better for me. It made it more fun for me. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the specifics of the content, but it, you know, there was a lot of stuff that I was worried might turn off non-wrestling fans. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it centers around a group called Millennium Wrestling Federation in Lincolnton, North Carolina. A very small town, rural town. Once a wrestling hotbed, it's described as. In fact, they kind of decided to run there after everyone else had pulled out. And it's very low key in the tone and just how it kind of shows. You know, the setting, it shows the characters, it shows what's going on, but it's there isn't a lot of use of like heavy music or, you know, there's some voiceover that the characters give, but it's not like it relies on that. I liked that. It's very much, it tells the story simply and not aggressively, if that makes sense.
It does. The minimal voiceover is incredible. The music, I think, was about, I mean, I watched so many wrestling documentaries when I was writing that piece for Grantland, and one of the most impressive things when you watch them all together is how it's just the way that they use the music in Fake It So Real. It's just minimal, and the music itself is good. It's sort of the polar opposite of the kind of WWE in-house documentary style of just like nonstop generic music that mm-hmm. kind of plays over every single thing that everybody says.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a very minimalist style overall, and I thought it was just really, really well executed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that it really captured the sense of, you know, community and brotherhood that these guys feel, and that, you know, I'm sure many wrestlers feel for each other. Though, you know, even in the movie, they kind of talk about how the kind of the close knit this might be kind of unique here, that they You know, there's not backstabbing behind the scenes. No one has to worry about their gear being stolen, so on and so forth. These guys seem to trust each other and like each other for the most part, even if they rib each other and even if they pick on the lowest guy in the totem pole quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all in good fun. It's like the sort of good fun that's really hard to watch sometimes. I mean, in a good way. It's, you know, it's, there's kind of a lot of built-in tension there, but yeah, they all really seem to genuinely like each other a whole lot. I mean, this, you could say this about any walk of life, but when you have something, you know, that means that much to you, you can share with somebody, then, you know, it's a pretty good basis for a good relationship.
Sure. And there's a lot of, and there's definitely different attitudes about wrestling from the characters. Some who, you know, who feel that they can actually make it on a bigger stage. Some who just sort of enjoy what they're doing now. So you get a mix of perspectives, a mix of ages, and in the wrestlers, different points of life that they're at. And it's just a nice, you get kind of a broad spectrum. I mean, I'm not saying it's like trying to say anything more than it is or capture like a bigger story, but it's definitely, you get a lot of diversity, I guess.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, well, like you said, it's all people from all different walks of life. I mean, despite the fact that they're all from a small town in North Carolina,
right.
you get to meet some very, very the kind of disparate personalities.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the first main character is Gabe, and he's the rookie, been in training for about 8 months. I think the best way to describe him might be overeager.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, watching his mind work is one of the most fascinating things in the movie.
Yeah.
He was so committed, committed in ways that a lot of the guys weren't necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the way that they kept on trying to explain to him how to, like, what he needed to do was learn how to, you know, structure a match. And he would just kind of, like, his eyes would glaze over and he would start coming up with a different theme song for his character or something. Like, he was deeply committed to the idea of being a wrestler. He made the movie. I mean, his like soul was the soul of the film. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, you show that he's very much lacking focus, very much a dreamer. He's excitable. I mean, he's always kind of pestering the guys, for ideas or for, you know, or for feedback. And he just constantly needs reinforcement that what he's doing is right. The beginning of the film there, they show them about a week before the show, hanging up flyers around the town and Gabe shows up, and also with Chris Soler, who's his roommate, who is one of the younger wrestlers who was sort of in Gabe's spot before it's talked about. But he's there,
and who is the cousin of the director of the film, which was the way they got in. I mean, the connection to how it got made. So.
Oh, interesting. I obviously didn't know that. Okay, that's interesting. They end up, because they're late, they sort of end up taking turns chopping Gabe in the parking lot. And you can sort of get the idea of the rookie hazing that goes on. And they all, at a certain point, a bunch of them are all, you know, giving chops to each other. Just kind of like, you get parts of the movie where it's just like, okay, they're just kind of playing around. They're having fun. This is like, you know, not something they treat too seriously. And then they talk about, you know, kind of thinking about their character and growing up and wanting to protect the art form of wrestling, that kind of that mix of amateurism, professionalism that you see in all the different guys.
Yeah. And you talked about Gabe being Chris Soler's roommate, but I guess it's important to point out that he was, you know, just basically just crashing on his couch for months. Like he was looking for, I mean, probably couldn't find a good job in this town and was just determined to stick around. He was actually trying to leave town during the filming of the movie, but there was that one great scene where Chris Soler's landlord is coming to pick up the rent check, and they're apologizing for being late, and she's telling them that they need to cut the grass, And the whole time, Gabriel's standing behind the door eating like a bowl of cereal. And I don't, it even was mentioned, but it seemed pretty, it seemed like it was implicit that he was hiding in the shadow behind the door because it probably wasn't cool that he was living there, you know, as far as the landlord was concerned.
Right.
But it's sort of this really great, like, that what the movie does really, really well is let you experience the lows of just the sort of like regular life of the common life and the highs of the sort of just, you know, euphoric experience of being a superstar one night a month or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that was just really great in the movie, but that scene in particular where it's just like this guy's eating a bowl of cereal hiding behind the door of like a, you know, just, you know, a rental home or whatever I thought was pretty poignant.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And, and you know, you have a lot of, just scenes of like Gabe training, and he's trained like in this junkyard and these dilapidated buildings, and also in some more like suburban landscapes. But you get the sense that this is not necessarily a town that this is a town that people probably want to get out of more than want to be in, but, they're all seemingly stuck there, or, you know, some of them want to be there, but it's their home, but, they're all kind of, at the point where, at least for most of them, they're there and they're making the best of it. And they're using this wrestling to escape from it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a cool part about the movie, but always kind of one of the sources of tension for the viewer, is that you didn't want to feel like you were being too voyeuristic, you know, about their regular lives. And that's a part of many, many documentaries these days. And it's, you know, credit to the director of this film and others too, when it works, you don't have to feel too guilty, with the acts, you know, about seeing what you're seeing, you know, I mean, he kind of makes it's very, very, very human, and it's they're unapologetic, and it was really, really well done.
Yeah. And there's definitely there's another group scene where they're at what looks like a cookout, and there's a bunch of the wrestlers there, and some of the older wrestlers, the owner of the promotion, Outlaw, and one of the older guys who is David Hayes, who portrays like a cult-like figure. He's more of a manager than a wrestler. But
yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah, and they're all kind of there's more the ribbing of Gabe and kind of the – everyone's sort of implying that they think that he's gay. It's, you know, I think most of it is just is ribbing. They don't seriously think it, but there's enough of almost an obsession over it that you kind of wonder, like it's interesting how both the feelings that, you know, Gabe might be gay, and also in Chris Soller's character, who
right.
the Queen City Classic, who is essentially, he isn't really playing a gay character, I guess, but he's the character that he's playing is he is angry when the fans chant that he's gay.
Right. It is sort of a very, I mean, again, it's handled really, really deftly in the movie. It's awkward. It's just awkward enough to make you care. But it's not, you know, it's not like an exploration of like, you know, of homophobic tendencies in people. I mean, what's clear right from the start, from that cookout scene anyway, is that I think, you know, there's parts of them that really do think he's gay, and, you know, it's not the most politically correct way to approach the subject, but it's clear that even if you know, as much as they might think that, they still really love the guy, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not their vocabulary is not the same, and I don't mean they're not intelligent, I just mean they just like their cultural vocabulary is not the same as everybody who's going to be watching the film. I would venture most people are watching the film, but there's, you know, there's not any animosity in it. And then knock my headset off. Then that coupled with the Chris Soller thing, where when he comes to the ring, the crowd's role is to chant "Soller is gay" over and over again at him. And when I saw it, like I said, in a yard full of hipsters in Brooklyn, I was kind of sitting on my hands at that point, because I felt like you know, I want to play along. I wasn't going to cheer out during the movie, but like I get, you know, it was kind of getting amped up by the crowd on the on-screen crowd. And then I was like, you know what? Maybe Solar is gay is not like the, is not what's really going to go over here in Brooklyn. But after the match, you know, some of the guys were there and they wrestled. I mean, after the show, they wrestled a couple of matches and the entire backyard was chanting Solar is gay, which was like one of my favorite, like, live experience wrestling moments. I mean, including real, you know, including WWE shows and Ring of Honor shows and like whatever, like that was, it was really cool. It was a good testament to like how, you know, powerful wrestling can be in general, but also, you know, how important the kind of interactive nature of it is too. So.
Right. And there's a lot of that shown with the interactions with the crowd. I mean, there's a decent amount of, day of the show filming of the crowd of, you know, people getting angry, people yelling at the wrestlers. There's one nice scene with, I think it's Brandon Powers, who's one of the more like technical wrestlers, like well built, and he's talking to a lady in the crowd, and he asks the lady, "Oh, what do you think I should do to him?" And he's like, "Oh, I think you should kick his ass," or you know, something along those lines. It's just you know, funny the different ways they show to present the crowd, and that they do add life to the proceedings for sure. Obviously, wrestling crowd would do that, but these people are definitely like, there's not really much irony or anything in this wrestling crowd. I mean, this is a very like genuine, like, we're into the show, we're treating the show seriously, and not like, you know, chanting sarcastic things or anything like that. I mean, it's very much like a back to the 80s type crowd.
Right. I mean, and that's I'm sure that a lot of the people who were there, I mean, I'll say about half the people there were under the age of 10, it looked like.
Yeah.
But of the older crowd, I'm sure that was the same crowd that was there that they were talking about when the shows used to come through. I mean, I actually don't have like the details on that, but presumably that was Jim Crockett territory. And by the time that, they were on, you know, national television, they probably weren't doing all the small towns anymore. You could still go to Greensboro or whatever to see them pretty regularly. And then they started expanding. They tried to basically go semi-nationwide, and that's what bankrupted the company. And it, you know, it's a sad story, you know, for Major League Wrestling competition or whatever. But it's a sad story for the small towns too. I mean, for the people for whom wrestling was a big part of their lives, and that's what's one of the really cool things about this movie is it's these people who are not only living out their fantasies, but they're giving something back to where they came from. And you know, it's like. The wrestling is obviously the draw of the movie, but it's almost like it could have been about anything, right? I mean, it's about these, it's about the culture of these guys, and it's about the community they live in, and it's this sort of like immersive experience of being a part of that. But yeah, I mean, it's the fans, the feel you get for the city, which I thought was really well done in the movie too. It's all kind of part of the same fabric.
Yeah. I like the quote of "you want to treat the audience like they're stupid."
Like, right.
They're not stupid, but they, you know, that's kind of the money thing when they're trying to explain to Gabe when he has like these like really elaborate talking about like he has a character with like a rainbow halo and he wants to have feathers on his costume that if he hits somebody like they'll float up, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and before we fully get away from the thing where they think Gabe is gay,
sure,
we must address the fact that he does seem to be going to a costume shop and accidentally buying like gay rave costume stuff for his wrestling character. Like he's so oblivious to the notion that you know or whatever that he's just like coming. I mean, he's coming out dressing like somebody who's trying to look gay.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
And so, you know, and so when they're joking around with them, there's certainly like there's certainly an element to which like this is a joke that must be made for the sake of everyone here. But yeah, I mean, his mind is always racing ahead or like to a new, a different character or it's kind of racing in multiple directions. It's very seldomly like right there in the moment sort of. And yeah, anytime he's on the screen, it's compelling. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would just say he's certainly a worker too. There's no question about that. You know, that he certainly feels like a personality that belongs in professional wrestling, at least as far as the reputation of professional wrestlers go.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that makes some sense. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And the treating the audience like they're stupid thing, I think, is a great. I mean, is an important point. I mean, one of the cool things about this movie is you see these guys just talking shop throughout the show. And you see that, I mean, they hit on some points of real kind of, like, clarity. I mean, some very, very just kind of central wrestling points. And these aren't guys that we even went to wrestling school. A couple of them were something approaching sort of, like, itinerant, you know, traveling wrestlers at various points in their life. But most of them are just guys that learned from the other guys.
Sure.
And they kind of hit on these, like, universal truths of the pro wrestling world. Throughout the movie. And one of those is treat the audience like they're stupid. I mean, there's a certain point where you know, in this modern era or whatever, we like kind of like more highbrow storylines and reality-based storylines or whatever. But you're on a curve when you're talking about those things. I mean, really, the basic building blocks of pro wrestling is this sort of traditional morality play. And you have to do whatever you're doing in the ring has to be as clear to the person in the 50th row as it is the person in the front row. So like the very, very like basic, I mean, like the basic nature of wrestling is the sort of outsized acting and simplicity of storytelling, especially when you don't have a TV show to convey plot points or whatever. I mean, you really do just treat the audience like they're stupid because that's the only way they're going to enjoy it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And I another thing from that scene when Gabe is talking with David Hayes is he's kind of getting into his backstory about he says he's discharged from the army. He had alcoholic parents. That even though you know he knows he shouldn't, he smokes and he drinks. And then talks about the reason he moved to this area is because of a fiance who he had a bad breakup with, and there was a restraining order. He called himself a little too persistent in calling her. And I love that David Hayes is like, so you're the psycho ex-boyfriend then?
Yeah. I mean, that was really – it was super sad. I mean, just in general, but I mean, just this, everything he went through. And you kind of get the impression that like – if he did something bad, he legitimately wasn't aware of what it was.
Right.
And it's like even odds that he didn't do anything bad, and just the fact that the justice system doesn't really favor, you know, poor people, that like he may well have pled guilty to something that he didn't do because that's what someone advised him to do.
Sure.
So yeah, it was just kind of, and they didn't obviously go into it very deeply, but they did just sort of like, it was like this really significant layer to his character.
Uh-huh.
Because he was just this sort of dreamer, you know, he was the simple new guy and, you know, whatever, like that could have been his whole role in another film. That might've been all he did. And then there's this sort of like, just really uncomfortable reality that kind of like that kind of wanders in the middle of a scene.
Yeah. I also like his quote, I could have appealed it and I would have won. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I it's interesting because I thought of him, I didn't take that he was being as innocent as you seem to, as you know, I took it a little bit differently, as a little bit more, not sinister, but just kind of like a guy who, it sort of makes a lot of excuses and sort of is a guy, not exactly like a con man, but definitely like a guy willing to manipulate or put the facts in a way that's going to make him seem kind of sympathetic. And obviously we don't know the entire story, so it's hard to see what was true, but I kind of took it with a little bit of a different shading.
Yeah, no, and I think you can take it both ways. I mean, I think the important thing is that is that his character all of a sudden it's, you know, it forces you to think more deeply about this guy who was sort of playing a very simple role up to that point. I mean, an right. important role for the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but it's clear that he's like that he's just confused about a lot of stuff. And I don't know if, I mean, you could very well be right that he might know full well what he's done and sort of like confused as to the gravity of it or what. And I don't mean to say this guy's dumb. I mean, it's, but he's like, but there is this sort of like, his character is, I mean, we all sort of know people like him, but I don't think we know them as well as you sort of learn to know Gabe through the course of this movie.
Sure.
And it's, this guy's obviously just not like, the wrestling is the thing that's holding his life together. He's not making a lot of good decisions outside of this one thing that he's just suddenly very passionate about.
Yeah.
He moves away. I mean, right, he's planning on moving away, which like violates his parole anyway. And the consequences don't seem to have a very, don't seem to always be at the forefront of his mind. I guess that's the important thing to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's even, you know, a reference to the fact that he violated his probation and had to go to jail and had to miss one of their earlier shows. So,
right.
You know, and he talks about thinking about everything that he would have done at the show, you know, just, okay, it's this time. This would be when I was helping put together the ring. This would be when I'm doing that. This would be when, you know, so on and so forth. So it's interesting. Him breaking that down, I thought was another poignant moment.
Yeah, no. Well, yeah, like I said, every time he's on the screen, he got your attention.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Chris Soller, because we get to a point where we meet his family, and they talk about he has had a rough past of surgeries. He was born with his intestines outside of his body. You know, he's had to, deal with a lot of physical ailments throughout his life, yet, you know, overcame it and, you know, and is wrestling here. And it's very much, you can tell that his dad isn't too crazy about this wrestling thing, which, you know, not a surprise. I'm sure most parents wouldn't be that crazy about a guy spending as much time, as much resources in professional wrestling, especially when one of the other main characters, Zane, who's notable for his big bushy beard, and is sort of one of the guys who's sort of one of the second level guys, maybe being groomed for a bigger role, talks about that he's made $0.00 in 21 months as a wrestler.
Yeah, and doing a lot of the backstage work, like you were saying too, which is the kind of crazy thing. Like, you always hear about the, you know, stories about the kind of corrupt wrestlers or whatever. I mean, corrupt promoters that just kind of like pocket a bunch of money and only pay one or two guys or whatever. But like, you know, they talk about the financial setup when they're, you know, when they're during the course of the movie. And it's just, you know, it's easy to see how like they're only breaking even.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there just weren't that many people there to see them on any given night. And, you know, when the kids get in free you know, it makes it clear that it's just a passion project for all of them.
Yeah.
And most of them are really, really, I mean, I think Chris Soller probably over the course of the movie says it, but, you know, most of the people there are really straightforward. Like, well, of course I'm never going to be a real professional wrestler, or I'm never going to make it to WWE or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of what makes it so compelling that they go out and do this. They do this every week and every month, and it's incredibly cool to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's definitely a guy who sort of takes Gabe under his wing a little bit, and I mentioned sort of resenting the treatment that Gabe gets, because, you know, he kind of got it himself when he was new, because he was one of the newer guys there. And he's got a low-key personality. Even his wrestling persona, like, interesting for a gay character, and I guess it's part of because this group is very family-friendly. It isn't really super flamboyant or super over-the-top or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I think it's just mostly that he's, I don't know how many people listening to this will be from the South, but there's a certain kind of, like, old-fashioned Southern sensibility that I definitely grew up around, where, you know, like, gay and like hippie are sort of the same thing. You know, I mean, just gay is like a kind of like a stand-in word for countercultural or something like that. Because he had the long hair and the scruffy goatee, and he dressed flamboyantly, but not flamboyantly like gay. Like, Gabe was actually dressing in like gay club outfits and stuff by accident. Like, he was just dressed like, you know,
like your like your average like pretty boy wrestler in the late 80s, early 90s, like a rocker basically.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, exactly. He's dressed like one of the rockers. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So it's not like he was not playing a gay character. He was just playing a. He was sort of like. I mean, I think that's sort of what insulates it from being like too crass that they're chanting that he's gay. It's that he's the one that is. He's the only person offended by this, and he's the heel, right?
Right.
Like everybody's just calling him gay just solely to afflict, just to make him mad. Mm-hmm. There's one of like the most weird and compelling scenes in the movie. So where he's just being interviewed one on one. He talks about how he got into wrestling or who his influences were. He's like, yeah, I wanted to be just like The Rock or Chris Jericho or whatever. And then he starts talking about the chant and how like, even though everybody's mad at him, it like that's what fuels him. And then he just does the chant himself standing alone in his living room,
yeah,
pumping his fist. And he's just totally into it. And it's just so weird and wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great scene. I agree. So we have J-Prep, who's kind of another one of the main figures here, and he has an ample posterior, as Jim Ross might say.
Yeah, he's a kind of weird shaped guy. He's not like a fat, not like he's like a like obese fella.
He's bulky, but yeah.
He's sort of bulky from the waist up and like, you know, Rikishi from the waist down.
Right.
He, you know, uses that to his advantage. It's one of those weird things about men in spandex that he actually looks much more sort of normal when he's out there in like pink bicycle shorts than he does when he's walking around in like, you know, cargo shorts and a t-shirt.
That is weird. Yes, but you're absolutely right.
But yeah, he's just I know one of the trailers started off with it, and I feel like it was the beginning of the movie. I'm getting my sequencing confused, but there's a part where he basically just like is cutting up like a Dusty Rhodes promo from the 80s.
Yeah.
The old like, you know, the Pork and Beans and King and Queens promo. And he's really good. He's kind of a good talker. And he's definitely like, you know, the crowd loves him. There's one really, really, I mean, one part near the end where he does a suicide dive out of the ring and botches it. Like he caught his foot or something and like, almost killed himself and his dance partner it turned out to be fine. He was really, really apologetic, hitting himself for it backstage.
Yeah.
But it was really like really cool because it was him trying to not just be the guy with the big ass doing the comedy routine. Like he very deliberately decided to do it because he wanted to grow as a wrestler and be respected as a wrestler.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot, you know, I mean, you see, and it's not just you people in this movie trying to get respect. I mean, this is this is a story you hear about a lot of guys in wrestling where they're kind of people have to teach them to not do crazy stuff when it doesn't benefit their character at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with like, you know, Big Show's off the top rope drop kicks from back in the day or Randy Orton doing all the top rope stuff that he kept like breaking bones doing. Like, it's not that integral, but you see with guys who really are passionate about the sport of wrestling, you see this like desire to improve and to make the audience happier any way you can.
Right. And he, I think, speaks most explicitly as being a guy who cares about the art form, who cares about independent wrestling, who knows a lot about the North Carolina wrestling tradition, or at least talks a bit about it and a bit about even mentions Vince McMahon by name and killing off the territories. And now, you know, he wants to be a part of, you know, making indie wrestling successful and being as something that he really cares about. And he really does seem like, out of everyone there, he does seem like he has a very natural ability to entertain. And he talks about, because he apparently thinks that he got his physique because he would get steroid injections to his butt because when he was a kid, he had severe lung problems. And,
right.
And you know, throughout his life, he, you know, heard all the jokes and made it hard for him to date and make friends. And so he even explicitly says, because he's a pretty grew up in a religious family, that he believes God put him in wrestling because that was where, you know, he prayed and that's where, you know, he wanted to go. And it's definitely a fit, and it kind of feels it gives sort of the element of pro wrestling, I hate to say the word, but I don't think any other word applies, the freak show aspect of wrestling, of seeing people of different shapes and sizes, you know, kind of going back to the carnival days.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and it was big in the carnival. I mean, I've been like so deep into wrestling, like old wrestling history the past couple of months, with some writing stuff that I'm doing. And it was especially big with this guy, Jack Pfeffer, who outed wrestling in the papers as being staged. He was despised. I mean, he didn't always have work. They kind of would let him in and then let him into the trust and then kick him back out, this old promoter. And one of the reasons they hated him is because he would like import freaks from Europe. He just like weird hunchback guys and bring them in, and the fans loved it, but the other promoters thought it delegitimized the sport.
Sure.
Which, you know, and his argument would have been like, there's no legitimacy in the sport. You know what I mean? Nobody thinks this is real fighting. But that's certainly there. The Federation has like every element of, I mean, I'm going back to the movie, the Millennium Wrestling. Is it Millennium? Is that right?
Yes.
I got this wrong at one point in the piece. They have sort of like so many just archetypes of the wrestling world where like you don't have to know about wrestling to appreciate this. Mm-hmm. But even if you haven't watched wrestling since you were, you know, since you were like in fifth grade or something like that, you'll recognize who each of these people is or who like the various parts of their personalities are. And that's what, you know, and J Prep is just sort of like Dusty Rhodes meets Rikishi, I guess. I mean, that's just sort of like his gimmick, and he's really great.
Yeah, yeah, he's really fun. And he talks about that, you know, he started off in Millennium and then went on the road for like 18 months after he kind of had a falling out with Jeff, the main promoter, Outlaw, and just basically was abused on the road, got 9 staples to the head in a match, lost his fiance throughout it, and just an experience that, he didn't have the same sort of trust and camaraderie that he had with the people here. Eventually he was let back in and is part of it again. And then that's all explained pretty well in a monologue where they...
Yeah, they go through with most of the main guys and give them each a sort of format, and give them each sort of the format to kind of explain their own stories. And a lot of, I mean, they're all totally first person and they could be full of untruth for all that we know. But yeah, his is pretty compelling, you know? I mean, all the guys just have such a, I mean, I was going to say he's like the most likable guy on the movie. But you know, all of the guys are presented in such sort of like human ways that it seems like they're all, I mean, a lot of them are really cool guys. And I actually, like I said, when I saw the movie the first time, more than half the guys from the film were there to wrestle that night after the screening. Mm-hmm. And I got to hang out with them a little bit. I mean, not like, you know, like super buddy buddy hanging out or whatever, but I met them, and then, we had some drinks afterwards. I mean, it wasn't just me and them. But they were just like the nicest, sweetest guys. They were like even more personable than they were on the screen.
Yeah.
And they just were so grateful to be given, like, for them, that movie that night in New York was like, that was WrestleMania.
Right.
You know, I mean, cause it's like, no matter what they could have, like all of the, there's a lot of stuff in the movie that like you or I or any normal person would not be super thrilled to have on film being shown to a large crowd. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's the gay stuff. J Prep, I think, says some like kind of like has some sketchy uses of words at some points during his monologue.
Yeah.
And I didn't even catch that the first time. And he was like coming to me after, like asking me what I thought, and if he should feel, and you know, because he felt bad about it. And I was just like, I don't even know what you're talking about, but no, I don't know. I didn't know what he meant. But he was like, totally, they were all like such sweet guys. And despite all the you know, the kind of too close for comfort stuff that might have been in the movie for them, they still got to be wrestling in a movie that, like, lots of people were going to see.
Right.
And so it was an incredible, like, added bonus. I mean, it was like the next chapter of the story, and it just made it so much more touching for me to see how much they appreciated how much everybody loved the movie. So.
Yeah, I like that he talks about one of the things that sort of like his family all kind of laughed at him when he got involved in the wrestling, but at least like I think he's mentioned like showing his mother that he was listed in like a magazine in like one of like the PWI rankings. Like I think he said 299 out of 300, but he got a couple of mentions there, and then suddenly that was kind of like a thing that, you know, impressed them, which is just kind of interesting. But the power of the printed word, I guess.
Yeah, I mean it's a really strange thing. I mean, I as somebody who writes for a pretty mainstream outlet, I can say firsthand that like the difference between writing for the internet where a bazillion people can see it and writing for something that's in print if five people see it is still pretty significant to your parents.
Yeah.
You know, it was a relatable moment as far as I was concerned anyway.
So kind of the big angle that they're building toward on the show is the team of Zayn, who we mentioned before, is the guy with the big bushy beard. And then Hojo, who's basically described as the angry black man, kind of, I guess, like a New Jack type, but a baby face. And the idea that Zayn had turned on Hojo, and they show a clip of it from one of the previous shows, if not the previous show, and worried that like it didn't come off well because it was Zayn getting a tag and then he and Chris Zoller facing off. And then them sort of like fake fighting for like a second and then hugging and then them attacking Hojo. And they worry about like that the crowd like it goes silent at first. Then finally they, you know, the heat comes and people are, you know, going crazy. And I guess it was something they didn't even tell the locker room. So the locker room were all kind of surprised that it had happened, which I thought was sort of interesting there.
Yeah. Well, it's important to not tell the locker room when that's like when you only have like 50 people in there. You know, you probably need those like extra five voices of shock coming from somewhere.
There you go. That's a good point.
But yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. It's weird when you watch mainstream wrestling, as you and I do, and as I'm sure most people listening to this do. It's really hard now for an angle to not go over. Because one, they're so good at it. I mean, because they've been doing, you know, the WWE has been around for so long. I mean, they have like the formula down. Also, because they have the video packages that just telegraph everything a mile away. And when you complain about something, it's usually that you know, a heel turn or something was way too obvious. Mm-hmm. That we all knew that was coming or whatever. But like, and this, they're working on this totally different scale, where not only are, I mean, we're first of all, like, people have to remember the storylines from like month to month. I mean, the fans, and then they're still working in this, you know, treat the fans like they're stupid format where, you know, they're the good guys are the goodest good guys and the bad guys are the baddest bad guys. And to convey a heel turn, which is one of the simplest part building blocks of wrestling, it's still like very, it's you can see how tricky it is. Mm-hmm. And you know, on some level it makes you appreciate what we have in the big leagues. And then on some level it makes you, there's something so much more real about what they were doing. Because in real life, you know, it's not always super clear what's going on right away. So, yeah. But anyway, yeah, that was a really cool moment.
Interesting that you talk about WWE storytelling because you talk how well they do it and how they present it, and sort of the same thing with documentary filmmaking now. You talked about the beginning where, if the subject is compelling enough and you have any sort of, ability to capture the story, it's going to be really good just because it's a good formatted. It's a, you know, they, you have, I don't want to call them tricks, but you have like, you kind of the, just the way you do it, it's just such a good formula that it's most of the time, if not always, going to be at least interesting and at least, kind of compelling.
Yeah.
That just made me think of that when you were describing how WWE does that. But they kind of, it just it's sort of interesting how formulas can. You, and I guess that's how when you make things enough, and when people make things enough, and you see how it's done well, if you come some sort of approximation of that, you can usually come up with something that's pretty good. Of course, then again, you see the formula too much, and it starts to get old. But.
Right. I mean, I'm not the first person who's compared, wrestling or a million other things in life to jazz, but there's only a few kind of standard pieces of the wrestling match and wrestling psychology, and you just have to, did they talk about jazz in the movie? Didn't they say that wrestling is the great American art form and it's not jazz because that's old or something?
Yeah, I believe that was J. Prep who says that.
Yeah, but anyway, that was a great line. I can't
Yeah.
even, I totally forgot about it until I just said that. But
Uh-huh.
wrestling's got it's kind of basic steps, and it's not the hardest thing in the world to do a really easy match, a really straightforward match as long as you don't overcomplicate it. But sort of like the more complicated you get, the better you have to be to pull it off. They struck a really interesting balance, I think a really successful balance in their shows with being not, obviously not overly complicated, but not too simple. They still gave their fans, I mean, their characters had some nuance, and the matches, they seemed to be really, they seemed to take a lot of pride in the way the matches were booked, and it was a lot of fun to watch the whole thing from, just the whole production from start to finish.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the Ararat Pit. There's a great scene where he is showing his collection of weapons, of toys,
Oh yeah, how weird is that?
of porn. He's got a trash can with his own blood on it. Just a great, just a great sequence of him just going through his room and talking about. He shares a story about a guy who was his friend or roommate who they had a falling out, and then he beat him up, and the friend came back or ex-friend came back and had a gun and shot him through that went through his leg. And then he said that he, right afterward, he beat him up again,
Yeah.
And I just like, and he talks about how he sort of keeps it family friendly in Millennium, but he's kind of portrayed he's racist and sexist in other places. And I thought he was just an interesting guy and an interesting character and just really interesting imagery throughout that whole scene. And they also show him as El Super Bisto, so he has this mask character, so he's a bad guy and a good guy at
In
the
the
same
great
time.
in the great tradition of indie, I mean, of old school territorial wrestling, where you have a guy just come out a second time during the night wearing a mask as someone completely different.
Right.
I grew up in Louisville watching, Jerry Lawler and the Jarrett's Memphis territory, and they did that junk all the time. I mean, of course, I wasn't aware of it for the longest time, but they were notorious for sending guys out like two or three times a night in various roles. So
Sure.
I thought that was hilarious.
That was funny. And I he even sort of says, well, no one knows that I'm the same guy, but probably everybody knows that I'm the same guy,
Right. Yeah. No, that was great. I mean, that's like exact. That is sort of like another one of those moments of like, great profound insight. Like that is professional wrestling, right? It's like, yeah, well, everybody, nobody thinks it's real, but kind of everybody thinks it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a really great. I don't know. I thought like that just that his character, just the introduction of that second character, I thought was just wonderful for that.
And he sort of has he mentions like having ambitions to be a guy who is going to be who could be successful and and actually making big time money. He didn't mention WWE, but that's obviously would be the only option, although realistically he probably doesn't seem to be a guy who could do that. I do like his other quote of, if I didn't wrestle, I'd have to pay for a therapist, which I'm sure is the case for a lot of wrestlers and a lot of people who just, you know, who are indulging their passions. That's obviously, you know, the escape and the working out your mental anguish is certainly probably fuels a lot of what people do for their hobbies.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. I mean, some people run and, you know, do whatever just to like kind of get it out of your system, get the anxiety out. And this was clearly his. I mean, the scene, well, to go back, the scene with him going through all his weapons and stuff was just hilarious. Cause like most of the places, I think all the guys in the movie, like, I don't believe that any of them are still living at home with their parents, but they all have apartments that look sort of like they're living at home with their parents.
Right.
They just have like posters on the wall and I'm sure we'll get to Outlaw at some point probably, but he, like, they show him in bed at one point and he has like just like the weirdest like sheets on his bed and like unmatching pillowcases and then there's just the closet full of weapons and like plunder. I mean, really, it's like somebody took a shopping cart from the old ECW days and dumped it out in his closet.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know. It's just really awesome just to show his, like, the insight into his mind through his closet is sort of like the best way in, I think. And that was that was pretty hilarious.
Yeah. Another thing they do with a lot of the guys, definitely with Che Prep and with David Hayes and with Chris Soler, is they show like them getting dressed for work, or they show them at least at work. I don't think they show David getting dressed. They also show Brandon Powers. They have a small scene with him at work, which is interesting because he works like in an office, and they talk about him kind of being the most normal guy, and he's probably in the best shape and he tans, but he's definitely a guy who's like, you know, I we're not going to be stars. This is just me, you know, having fun. I like being the big fish in a very small pond. But it's fun because they show him in an office setting, and they have one short scene where he's talking to one of his coworkers, pitching having the guy come, and the guy clearly couldn't really be less interested in going. But he's like, "Oh, you know, we'll even give you a free ticket," which I guess sort of defeats the purpose of inviting a guy to a show. But
yeah,
I guess they don't make much money. But
it was so uncomfortable. I mean, I'd like, and he was really good. I mean, he was the sort of guy that, like, if he lived in Philly in the mid 90s, he could have been in ECW and been pretty successful. Like, he's you know, probably 5'8" or something like that, but he's like well built and seemed to be a pretty good hand in the ring.
Yeah, like a Mike Modest type, maybe, or somebody.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, and probably not nearly as good as Mike Modest, but like, you know, he was certainly good enough that, like, right place, right time, he could have been a guy you would have heard of.
Sure.
But yeah, and he's definitely sort of like held up with that sort of respect amongst the guys too. I mean, he's like, it's almost like he's their ringer. Like, he comes in and knows how to have really good matches and do a lot of moves that none of the other guys can do. And yeah, it's, I mean, that scene with his coworker was so odd that I was just hoping that, like, he's, you know, driving 45 miles to the show and they didn't tell us that or something, because that was the only way that wasn't like a painful experience to watch.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, and he was like super level headed. He was an accountant, and he was just like, or a CPA, whatever he was, and he was in, or insurance. Is that what you said?
I forget exactly, but yeah, I mean, it was basically,
but he just had like
a business office.
Yeah. He was just like working in a cubicle and doing pretty well for himself. And this was just like a thing he does once a month. And it was, I don't know. Yeah. He was probably the most normal person there, right? Wouldn't you say? I mean,
or at least like
for one, he had a day job, and I mean, I guess a lot of the guys had day jobs.
Yeah.
Those are the, but like he had, for me, a sort of like relatable day job, and he just seemed like just kind of quiet and nice and stuff, and he was just kind of like went out and kicked ass in the ring.
Yeah, he's definitely the most middle class guy, I would probably say.
Yeah,
for sure, but. But yeah, we should talk about Outlaw, since he is, he's the guy who runs the promotion. Seems like he's always clad in that Carolina Panthers jersey. He's the guy who runs the show, but the story here basically is that he's laid up in bed. He's had some, medical issues with Sis, and they think it might be a staph infection. And the whole thing is that he hasn't missed a show in 10 years and takes an immense amount of pride in that, even before he was, you know, the before he owned it, before when he was just a when he was just one of the boys, as he puts it. So obviously, you know, you're dealing with a little bit of chaos where, okay, what are we going to do because Outlaw might not show up?
Yeah. I mean, it was just like, of course the show was going to go on, but it was, I mean, and they were all very, they're all very committed to it. I mean, they were just like, yeah, we'll just go out there and do the thing we always do and whatever. But there was this just like subtle sense of desperation where they, and no one even said it. I mean, there was a point where Gabriel was just like, it's going to be just so messed up if he's not here. And somebody said they were going to go drag. Was it Gabriel said he's going to drag him to the show, whether or not he wants to come? Like, there was certainly like people were seemed to be upset that he wasn't, you know, they regretted the fact that he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
But like beneath that, they just seemed to be like they almost weren't sure if the show could was going to work without him there, and not like the storylines, like maybe just the building would fall down, you know, or something. And
and
they never said it, like I said, out loud, but it was, you know, it was pretty compelling.
It was like they needed him there just for their confidence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, they didn't know what to do with that.
Right. So, but he's pretty, I mean, he's definitely kind of that, he's older and more weathered you know, he doesn't really have like the strongest personality. I mean, you know, he's certainly an interesting guy, but really the story is sort of his absence more than his presence. But he kind of talks about a guy who's just sort of had a rough year and had trouble with, his kids. So that's sort of added details, that are part of the story there. But I like, we finally get to the show, and I love there's a pretty lengthy sequence of just showing them setting up the ring.
Yeah, that was really great.
Yeah, and just all the details of putting it up and taking down, everyone coming in, of tightening the bolts, and, everything's rusty and rough and beaten up and weathered and, you know, and like I said, mostly it works without dialogue. There's a little bit of voiceover, but really not. And there's some, you know, music that's in the background and that kind of thing. But really, it shows a lot about their dedication without, you know, saying it into words.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just the, you know, how they make the donuts or whatever. You see the whole ring getting put together. I mean, as a wrestling fan, as somebody who knows, like, in theoretically what happens, watching them set up the ring was like it made me ache, like that, like it's like watching them setting up the ring is harder than what I imagine wrestling to be like, you know. I mean, it was like this incredibly difficult process, and just that one guy was doing it by himself for like the first 30 minutes, and it's like you could see that just like setting up the ring could take like an entire day if your buddies didn't come and start helping you.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, I mean, that was, you know, part of just the kind of like communal, you know, aspect of the whole enterprise was clear then, because they just, you know, that they all have to pitch in just to set up the ring, you know, just to have a thing, for them to have a match on. And, I don't know. Yeah, that was a super cool scene.
Yeah. And then right afterward, which is, I think, my favorite part of the movie, and it's sort of just an aside that doesn't really have much to do with the story they're telling, but it's great because they have a guy who walks in and he's just, you know, he says, hey, I want to try out to be a wrestler. And so he sits down with Zane and Pitt, and, you know, they say, this is where we're going to try to talk you out of it and talk about, you know, the you need to have respect for us, and, you know, and we're you know, and we don't take any bullshit and so on and so forth. And then every question they ask of him just leads to like these looks of disbelief that he's like, he's 39 years old. He's got 7 kids. He suffers from asthma and is allergic to penicillin. He looks like he's in good shape and is sort of like, you know, seems like a reasonable guy on the surface. He doesn't seem like a Yahoo, but it's just it's fascinating to kind of go through that interview, and they kind of cut between that and they show Chris and Gabe and some of the other wrestlers kind of running the ropes and practicing moves and bumping and stretching and so forth. And so eventually he comes in and does the tryout, and actually the great thing about it is he's actually kind of good.
To watch him watch this guy show up just deciding at the age of 39 that he wants to be a wrestler. You know, and he's in pretty good shape, but so when you saw him just like do the first, take his first back bump in the ring, and the whole ring shook, and you could just feel, you know, like everybody watching it, I think like their teeth sort of rattled in their head.
Right.
But yeah, he just kind of like, he had it, and they were just, and I thought that was like an incredibly important part of it. 'Cause there were some other characters that sort of popped up towards the end, but just to see just the face of somebody who is like kind of wandering in saying like, hey, can I do this? Like, I want to be part of what you're doing. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it you know, if this were a work of fiction, it would be like, he would be terrible and he would be, you know, embarrassing, and everyone would be like, oh, you know, this is so hard and so forth. And they present it as like, it's difficult, but I love that twist where like, oh yeah, he's actually kind of good. Like, he could belong with us with some training and, you know, so on and so forth. They show, you know, more of the preparation. Gabe, they focus on him, putting on his makeup, doing a lot of the, he does a lot of the, still some sort of training and working with the guys. And you can tell that there's some things that he's not doing as well as one of the other newer wrestlers that they only show kind of briefly. And you know, in kind of setting up like, oh, is he really ready? Is he really ready? Those were some nice details. And again, Gabe's focus is like, he's working on his makeup. He's, you know, working on his outfit. Like, he's caring more about that than, you know, than these other things, which, you know, are more germane to the immediate moment.
Yeah. And then he goes out and has like the match of the night, though.
Yeah, that's the great thing. Yeah, they, you know, he and Pitt, like, you know, they go out there and they kill, and then, and everyone is like, just, and everyone comes up to him and is like, wow, what a great match, what fantastic. I think Outlaw, who does show up, he comes in right as they're about to begin, and you know, they show him laying out the show and, you know, kind of picking everything, and you can see everyone's confidence boosted up when he comes out there. And yeah, I mean, you can see that really the story of the match between Gabe and Pitt is just basically Pitt's this big guy who's beating up this little guy, and he has a tough physical match. He takes he takes a big ass kicking, but he comes off as tough and sympathetic and really good at selling anguish. I mean, even in like during the training, you can tell that he's good at selling and creating sympathy. Even some of the wrestlers are wondering of, you know, certain things he's doing, of whether, you know, he's hurt, and it kind of shows that as like maybe him taking it a little bit too seriously at that point, but it works during the match.
Yeah. It was absolutely great. And he's just like, you know, I mean, he's like small and like fit and, you know, pretty attractive, and you could tell that he was like, he's like the perfect, you know, little like baby face for an indie promotion like that. The fans talking about like, you know, wrestling functioning with like the kind of basic building blocks or working in broad strokes. I mean, like, he's just the most baby face that they could have sent out there.
Absolutely.
And he worked that match just sort of perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and it's just a nice, and you know, that really caps off the story well. And then we get sort of the main event with, it sort of turned into a tag match with Solar and Zane, basically a handicap match with Hojo. And they show kind of some of the fun antics with Solar and Zane, of them, you know, kind of getting beaten up and begging off, and Zane sort of enjoying his new heel personality. And at the end, we have sort of a big dramatic, although, you know, low key for them still, but dramatic for the movie, where they show Outlaw coming from outside of the building and walking in and coming in through the crowd, and you see the crowd recognize him, and he's really labored, really in pain, really awful, but he, you know, does a few things, kind of cleans house and then helps Hojo win. And then the story is that it's Hojo's career against Zane's beard. And Zane even mentions earlier, it's like, well, you know, I need to shave this thing off if I want to be able to get a real job. So then they have all the baby faces come in and help shave the beard. You kind of get the, you kind of get the nice, main event wrestling ending, a nice, not only for the movie, but for, you know, just what would be a nice ending for a great wrestling show.
Yeah. It was absolutely, it was awesome. I mean, like just to, like, you didn't even care. Like you weren't, when you're watching it, you're not responding to the bad guys as if you really don't like them in the way that you might if you were in the audience.
Sure.
But there was just sort of like some perfect feeling of like the formal ending to when somebody gets their beard chopped off. I think as lifelong wrestling fans, most of us know what that cue means. It's like the go home spot or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then, you know, we have that's basically the end. We have lots of hugs and celebration and everyone praising Gabe for his work. And then, you know, a little bit later of taking down the ring and the lights out. And that's basically the movie.
Yeah. I hope we didn't spoil too much for anybody, but the,
well, but, Mark's,
it's so worth watching. Like there's not like, this was, you know, the piece that I wrote is me basically saying like, this is my favorite wrestling documentary. I mean, they're much more significant, much more, educational and sort of a more straightforward way, but man, I just thought it was really great.
Yeah, me too. I really enjoyed it. It's really, great. Everyone should check it out.
And above all else, I mean, even if you disagree with me about its comparative, you know, accomplishment or whatever, but like this is the wrestling documentary that any non-wrestling fan will enjoy. I think if you're ever trying to like get, you know, a friend or like somebody you're dating or a roommate just to experience a little bit of why wrestling is awesome, this is totally appropriate for non-wrestling fans. You know, it's the most accessible wrestling thing that I could really even think of. So, you know, definitely use this should be in your repertoire one way or the other.
Absolutely. And it's available on iTunes for those who want to check it out. I think fakeitsoreal.com is the website. So people should definitely check it out. I highly recommend it as well. And one of my favorites, wrestling documentaries for sure.
Yeah. Definitely cool.
All right. Go ahead.
Go ahead, man.
Oh, I was just going to wrap it up, see if there's anything else you wanted to mention or plug anything in particular.
No, man. I mean, you can follow me on Twitter at AKA the Mask Man, and anything I write, I mean, it, for the most part, will be pretty accessible through the through my bio there. So, you know, you can check me out. But but thanks for having me. This is the it's a cool thing you're doing with the wrestling movies, and as you can tell, I'm a big fan of this one. So it's nice to have an opportunity to you know, spread the gospel a little bit.
All right. Well, yeah. Thanks a lot for being my guest. Appreciate that very much. Everyone, of course, check out WrestleSpective.com for all the WrestleSpective podcasts, as well as videos and pictures and many other things that go along with the podcast with some footnotes. So hopefully that'll amplify your podcasting experience. And keep on checking us out. And thanks for listening. And goodbye.